In the 1930s and 40s, radio in the United States was an experience unlike anything Americans had ever seen or heard before. Though the capabilities for mass entertainment broadcasting had existed for years, it was not until the late 1920s that radio began to reach its full potential.
Network radio, which began in the late 1920s, was really the first time that all of America could share the same experience.
It was your sole source of entertainment in the home. So whereas generations today sit around the computer or they sit around their television, you would sit around the radio.
You had this web of stations that would almost all carry the same thing, whether it was Jack Benny or Suspense or the Lux Radio Theater. With that, obviously, that was the birth of mass media in this country.
The idea behind tonight's play, Berkeley Square, in which a young man, through his love of the past, breaks through the barrier of time and finds the girl he loves in the 18th century. It was filmed by 20th Century Fox, and it comes to you tonight on the Lux Radio Theater with two favorite stars, Ronald Coleman and Maureen O'Sullivan.
You had everything from kids-driven programs.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Superman.
And then, of course, for the grown-ups, there was everything from comedies like Jack Benny and Bob Hope.
Tonight we're going to present a very different kind of a thing here. We have a thing here. Musicians, please, no tuning while the star is on, please. Now, as I was saying, please. Hey, you. Hey, Evelyn, stop with that magic violin.
I resent that.
Well, Jack Benny, ladies and gentlemen.
To the dramatic series, you know, like The Shadow and Suspense and things like that.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
It was called the Golden Age of Radio, and between 1932 and 1948, it was the only thing in existence that allowed people to electronically entertain themselves in their own homes. From California to Nebraska to New York, the entire country was captivated by the same entertainers. Radio united and entertained the masses, and for a brief period, seemed like it was here to stay. However, it wasn't to be. As we all know, radio has not retained that popularity. In the late 1940s, a new entertainment medium came along. Television allowed its audience almost all the benefits of radio, with one major addition. On TV, you could see the picture. As television became more accessible to the American public, radio executives realized more and more that their cash cow was quickly becoming the visual medium, rather than the purely audio one.
Radio just took all its formats, the situation comedy, the western, the detective show, the quiz show, the soap opera, and just moved them lock, stock, and barrel over into television.
With television taking over in the 1950s, the radio industry needed to do something drastic to stay relevant. During the next half hour, we'll learn what happened to the medium in order to keep it alive even to this day, as well as looking at the impact radio programs really had on the American public throughout the period that is still known, after all these years, as the Golden Age of Radio.
I think I know where it is.
Where?
Right in here in the hall closet.
It is I, Digby O'Dell, the friendly undertaker.
Henry Aldrich.
Coming, Mother.
Oh, Eric, you humorous. You're the Mark Twain of your generation.
Weed of crime bears bitter fruit. Crime does not pay.
The beginning of the end for radio came before radio was popular itself. The development of television had begun well before the Golden Age of Radio, but it did not have the capabilities to become the entertainment juggernaut early on that its audio counterpart did. As developments were still being made in TV, radio became the top electronic medium for keeping its audiences interested. But a big blow to the radio industry came in 1939 at the New York World's Fair. It was here that NBC introduced television to the American public for the first time. For a population that had viewed radio as high technology in the past, the obvious advantages of TV were mind-blowing. NBC President David Sarnoff further wowed fairgoers as he addressed them, illustrating his ideals for a world with television.
It is with a feeling of humbleness that I come to this moment of announcing the birth in this country of a new art, so important in its implications that it is bound to affect all society. It is an art which shines like a torch of hope in a troubled world. It is a creative force which we must learn to utilize for the benefit of all mankind.
Keep in mind that at this point, radio was still in its first full decade of entertaining the nation. Had TV become available to the public directly after the World's Fair, we might not still have radio today. It could have been a swift wipeout. But it was Sarnoff's line about finding a medium that could help mankind that actually served to benefit it. Not 3 months after the fair, World War II broke out in Europe, and with it, a whole new set of concerns for radio and television enthusiasts. Two years later, when the United States entered the war, attention shifted from expanding entertainment to helping the war effort. With any spare materials now being used on wartime supplies, there was not much room for growth in the new medium of television. Radio, which had long been established by now, used this to their advantage. Don Aston, the CEO of AV Pro, a company that preserves old-time radio shows, talks about how radio contributed to the United States war effort.
Radio went to war. You had bond drives on the radio, you had Support the Red Cross, you had your actors and your people that were in the drama and adventure shows and so forth at the end many times gave a spiel about if you're young and you want to be help our boys join the nurses' corps, buy stamps, don't support the black market, all this stuff. The radio went to war and supported the war amazingly.
War certainly changed a lot of the programming. Aston referred to World War II as a great boon to the medium, saying that the 1940s became radio's best years. It seemed like everyone was getting in on the act. Fred McDonald, a media historian, explains there was a lot that needed to change in this new era, but radio historian Bob Lyons reports that much of it was very good.
There were some restrictions, such as baseball guys doing the play-by-play would not mention that it's a sunny day, or a cloudy day or whatever, because we didn't want enemy aircraft knowing that the air was clear or not clear.
It's one of those things about war. They perfect aviation, they perfect communication, and that's what happened with radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, Molly and I and our sponsor would like to say that we're mighty proud to be associated with the radio industry, which at this moment is fulfilling its promise of instant communication in time of world crisis.
The next half hour will be devoted to bringing you information immediately as received by NBC's news bureaus.
Well, the war served to protect old-time radio for a little while, but it was only a matter of time before the walls broke down and television came storming through. And with the obvious upgrade that television offered, why exactly would radio's survival even be necessary? Bob Lyons, Virginia Upuse, Barbara Walsh, Robert Upuse, Loretta Wagner, and Don Aston provide at least a partial answer. Radio meant a lot to the people who lived with it.
Tonight, I'm good. And you.
medium. I mean, forget about television. Radio brought everything into your home.
I was probably 12 years old before we ever had a television set, so radio was all I remember.
I think I had more imagination when it was just radio.
In the 30s, 40s, and 50s, millions of people across the country were tuned into their radios for music, sports, and entertainment. Every day, audiences were thrilled with Golden Age programming.
I think it brought us all together like we had never been together ever. For the first time in history, a whole nation could be hearing the same thing at the same time, same speech, the same baseball game, same football game.
Sunday was a good day for a little kid because we used to sit around the radio and listen to the people read the funnies.
I remember the Lux Radio Theater, and I remember listening to The Shadow on Sunday afternoon. I think they used to be on at 4 o'clock. That was a great one, The Shadow.
Well, I remember the Lux Radio Theater. Every week was a different story. We listened to Fibber McGee and Molly.
I like Jack Benny.
Jack Benny.
Jack Benny. Whenever I hear Jack Benny, it becomes Sunday night to me because I can remember listening to Jack Benny and Rochester and Mary. And I mean, it was just part of our life.
Oh, so I'm going to have trouble with you, too. Now, what's wrong with your contract?
I don't like Clause 7.
Clause 7? Oh, Mary, it only happens around Thanksgiving.
I don't care. If you buy a turkey, kill it yourself.
That's all we did is listen to the radio. In fact, I would lay down in front of the radio in the living room and do my homework and listen to the radio shows.
I can remember when I'd come home from school, at 4:45 was Terry and the Pirates, at 5 o'clock was Superman, at 5:15 was Sky King or Jack Armstrong, at 5:30 was Captain Midnight. See, kids all around the country listen to this stuff.
Hey, fellas and girls, I've just had the biggest thrill of the season. I've just seen the new burnished bronze medal of membership of Captain Midnight's new 1940 Flight Patrol. That marvelous medal of membership that I've been telling you about with the thrilling three-blade spinning propeller and the mysterious new secret password.
Growing up, being the youngest of seven, and my brother being the oldest, 16 years older, we heard a lot of baseball. And if it came on during a children's program, we listened to baseball.
They used to have the fights on the radio, and they would describe what was going on. And I didn't really know what was going on, but it was just time that I would spend with my father. I'd sit with him, or he'd be laying down, and I'd just lay down next to him, and we'd listen to the fights. That was a big thing.
They're back to the microphone here now, and Joe lands a straight left and takes a straight left. He slips under Joe's hands, and they go into a clinch. It's not necessary to split them out. They're in the center of the ring, fainting, fainting. Watchfully, two fine athletes here. Joe tries with a long left. He tries to a long left to Sharkey's left eye, and it lands.
Unfortunately, I don't think there's that many types of programs on TV that would even compare with old-time radio.
For so many people in the 1940s, radio was all they knew. So when something new came along, though it had its advantages, many people were a little apprehensive. But the allure of moving pictures in the home was ultimately too enticing. Even for radio lovers, the times were definitely changing. As the golden age of radio started to slip into an era of memory, and the golden age of television was beginning, network executives on the radio side of operations began looking in different directions. With the public's eyes more firmly glued to the TV in the early to mid-1950s, Nostalgia Digest publisher Steve Darnell reports, new types of programming started to surface in radio.
I think to some extent they took advantage of the fact that nobody really cared. And that meant that shows that did offer a little more in terms of experimenting with the format could come into existence.
Since the late 1920s, radios across America were tuned into the same type of shows. Sure, there was variety, from comedies to quiz shows to detective thrillers, but aside from the different personalities and settings, there were very few truly original ideas. When this sudden change came in the format, new programs and new creative ideas blossomed. One such new show was the CBS Radio Workshop.
That was an experimental program, lasted about 18 months, and they did all manner of shows. Some were documentary style, others were dramas, or humor pieces. Others were simply experiments in sound. Maybe they had the freedom to do that because they didn't have much money, so they had to have a lot of imagination and a lot of freedom.
Yes, the CBS Radio Workshop even performed operas over the air. But that wasn't the only way in which radio producers were experimenting. As radio historian Jim Cox explains, by the 1950s, radio people knew their business was suffering, and although there were many interesting concepts to come out of the period, they came mostly in two late attempts to save a sinking ship.
While thousands were fleeing to television, here was something novel, unusual, different. It was just a unique way to reach listeners and try to hold on in desperation.
Desperation or not, it was during this period that one of the most important concepts in recent entertainment history came about. According to Don Astin,
CBS came up with the idea of an adult Western. Now, when you had Cisco Kid and Lone Ranger and Red Rider and all that stuff, those were juvenile Westerns. So they came up with an adult Western. And the most famous one was Gunsmoke.
Dolph, I'm willing to bet everything I got that if we find that herd, those calves are either still unbranded or missing.
What makes you so sure?
Tom refuses to ride out there with us.
What you're saying is mighty serious, Marshal. I hope you won't regret it.
There was a chance to create something that was hyper-realistic, to where, you know, the joke was that if you shot the Lone Ranger six times, five of the bullets would miss and the sixth might hit him. That wasn't the case with guys like Matt Dillon or Johnny Dollar.
Realism in radio started with the Westerns, but it expanded. Most detective shows in the 30s and 40s were not exactly juvenile, but they definitely didn't possess the hard edge that most of the 1950s dramas did.
It was the atomic age, and it was a time when people became a little more fatalistic about the fact that their lives could suddenly end through no fault of their own, and the millions of others could go with them. I think to some extent that might have influenced this particular trend.
This was a new slice of drama that listeners hadn't been accustomed to.
You know, it wasn't just men and women reading into a microphone and an occasional sound effect. That the directors and the writers and the actors and the sound effects people would work together to create very vivid pictures. The opening of Broadway Is My Beat, for instance, they go to great lengths to create the sound of New York City.
Broadway Is My Beat. Broadway's My Beat, from Times Square to Columbus Circle, the gaudiest, the most violent, the lonesomest mile in the world.
While much of the new programming in the 1950s was original creations, there were also attempts to rekindle the glory years. Many of these attempts came from the head of CBS, William S. Paley. In the late 1940s, Paley famously stole most of the top talent on radio from NBC and ABC. While much of the entertainment world expected the move to pay big dividends in the early TV game, Paley actually made the move with the intention of keeping most of his stars on radio, at least in the beginning. So throughout the early 1950s, CBS was supplying a lot of the traditional shows that listeners had grown accustomed to over the years. The move left NBC reeling, and the older network also took a traditional route in trying to save themselves.
Well, as much as the CBS or the NBC bottom lines were doing all right either way, the people who were in the radio end still tried to survive. They tried to create new things that would attract listeners.
One such thing was called The Big Show. NBC's attempt to stay relevant included this effort, a weekly hour-and-a-half extravaganza featuring much of the network's talent. Hosted by aging stage and film star Tallulah Bankhead, The Big Show, it can be argued, was the last big attempt made by a radio station to outdo television. Fred McDonald takes on this issue.
This one with Tallulah Bankhead and Fred Allen and tons of celebrity guests on and performing 90-minute variety show was sort of a Ed Sullivan show of radio.
And here is your hostess, the glamorous, unpredictable Tallulah Bankhead.
This is Radio 1950, the greatest stars of our time on one big program. And the most fabulous part about this, darling, is that every Sunday we will present other stars of the same magnitude.
The Big Show typically featured five or six big guests. Fred Allen, Bob Hope, Jimmy Durante, Louis Armstrong, and Frank Sinatra were just a few of the stars who made appearances on the program, which consisted of elaborate musical numbers, comedy routines, and a lot of Tallulah Bankhead. NBC placed a lot of pressure on their host, who later wrote that she had snatched radio out of the grave. Though that may have been the network's intention, their scheduling did not work out as hoped.
The timing was so that it would begin an hour before Benny came on CBS and would theoretically hold the crowd until he was off the air, because he was the big draw. It didn't work.
While NBC put more money and star power into The Big Show than had ever been done, CBS allowed Jack Benny to keep up what he had been successful with for years, and he was as popular as ever. NBC had gambled and lost with The Big Show.
It began in the fall of 1950, and they got into the second season and even took their show for a week or two over to Europe to broadcast, but By early spring or late winter of 52, the second season, it was off the air and a financial disaster.
Each episode of The Big Show reportedly cost as much as $100,000. And though NBC eventually recovered, when The Big Show failed, it sent a major message to radio executives.
It didn't last again because television was where it's at. Television was the promise that radio represented back in the early 20s, that someday you're going to be able to see what you're only hearing now. They could stand there and say, we've got a great new format, The Big Show, but it's not going to make much difference, and if it really is that hot a property, make it into film and move it to television.
As the decade wore on, that's exactly what happened. The Big Show never made the leap, but so many other big radio shows did. Perhaps the most notable ones were Dragnet and the aforementioned Gunsmoke. For as much impact as these realistic programs may have had on radio, they will always be remembered first and foremost as TV shows. The adult western and detective shows that had seemed like such great radio innovations turned out to be a great boost to television. With this, a whole new set of problems evolved for those in the radio business.
The sad thing is a lot of the radio stars could not transfer over to television because they didn't look like the parts that they had been playing.
William Conrad, who played Marshal Matt Dillon on Radio's Gunsmoke, was said to have never fully gotten over the fact that the TV producers never offered him any role on the show. But it wasn't just dramatic series that were affected. Many comedians had their careers come to a quick halt when they realized they were not suited for television.
These guys were top of their craft. Anybody who's at the top of his or her craft, and then they change the whole format, is going to be a little upset because it means all of a sudden you're back to square one and you're going to have to do something different.
Fred Allen's a good example. He did some television but never really was able to latch on.
That's the voice of Radio Classics host Greg Bell. As he explains, then there were the writers.
Writers felt that television was lazy because the visual was taking over so much of what they did. Their thought process was, in many cases, television was cheesy. Television was amateurish. The technology certainly wasn't there to make it pretty.
Others liked television a lot. The best example of that is Milton Berle. He was not suited for radio because he was a physical comedian. He was full of muggings and pratfalls, but television was perfect for him.
Berle led a group of comedians that included Red Skelton and George Burns and Gracie Allen, who thrived in television after less successful radio careers. Though TV in its infancy did not present the same visual spectacle that we often get today, it still presented a vast improvement over radio to most audiences, and there were plenty of performers who knew how to utilize that. So as the old guard departed radio, the performers and executives who didn't make the jump started working on a new format. Enter Monitor. Fred McDonald explains.
Monitor was a news and chat, but it also had, you know, they'd break for a Fibber McGee and Molly installment and other types of programming. But the whole idea was to try to coordinate what was left of radio and run it particularly through a news and information window.
I think that that was a natural reaction of radio to try to survive. How do we survive? Well, do we find formats that aren't being done well or as often on television and jump at those? So I think Monitor is a perfect one for that because it was sort of the 60 minutes of its time.
I still count it in my top five favorites. Millions were enthralled by it, and the beautiful part was you could tune in at any point of the day and listen and then tune out when you were ready to go somewhere else.
But it wasn't only Monitor in its news talk format. By the time the 1960s rolled around, networks had changed their strategies entirely.
You have to start thinking no longer about broadcasting, seeking the broadest possible audience, but you must start thinking now about narrowcasting.
Radio was a resilient force, and somehow or another, through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond, radio has survived. The late 1950s and early 1960s may have been as tough a period as the medium could want, but it lasted. Radio historians Martin Grahams, Greg Bell, and Jim Cox discuss why.
Radio kind of reverted back to what it originally was, news commentary, music, and speeches or live broadcasts from the different areas or remote areas.
The most interesting thing about radio and how it came out of the 1950s when TV sort of took over was how definitive some people were that radio would die, that radio was physically just going to go away. And people in their cars kept it alive.
I can remember taking radio along on picnics and swimming parties and anywhere and everywhere we went. It was a big deal in those days to buy an automobile that came radio equipped. That was as good as air conditioning would be now.
And air conditioning is pretty nice. Radio came out of the turbulent 50s as a medium used primarily for music and talk, listened to by people on the go, and there it remained. As shock jocks and top 40 stations rolled in, radio had found its niche. But within the last decade, the emergence of internet and satellite radio, as well as MP3 players, have changed the game slightly for broadcast radio.
In many cases, people are now starting their own radio programming on their own radio stations on the internet. Certainly the means of how you listen to radio has changed, but I don't think the content is any different than it was 30, 40 years ago.
Is there still room for terrestrial radio in the future? And if so, what changes will the industry have to make to remain relevant? Well, perhaps we'll answer those questions in another documentary, 50 years down the line.
There's so many formats and ways to enjoy audio that have faded away, and yet radio just manages to keep plugging along. So I guess it's all about being able to grow with the times.